Good afternoon. Our first panel this afternoon is on state-society relations, and I'm pleased to introduce our panelists. On my right, Professor Andrew Gamble, Professor of Politics, University of Cambridge. On my immediate left, Professor Mary Caldor, Professor of Global Governance and Director of Civil Society and Human Rights Security Research Unit at LSE. And on the extreme left, Dr. Sotirios Sartalodis, Lecturer in International Politics, University of Manchester. So if I can make the full introduction of our first speaker, Professor Gamble joined the Cambridge Department of Politics in 2007. Before that, he was Professor of Politics at the University of Sheffield, where he was a founder member and subsequently the Director of the Political Economy Research Centre and Pro-Vice Chancellor. He read economics at Cambridge for his first degree, then political theory at Durham, before returning to Cambridge for his PhD in social and political sciences. He's a joint editor of New Political Economy and the Political Quarterly, and a fellow of the British Academy and the Academy of Social Sciences. Each presenter will speak for about 15 to 20 minutes and will be followed by a Q&A session.
Andrew.
Okay, well, thanks very much for the invitation to speak today. We are competing with one or two other events. The Leveson report, I gather, is being published as I speak. And there are other, I notice also on the news today, there's the discovery of a new black hole in the universe, the second largest ever, 20 billion times the size of our sun. So if you think that we've got problems looking at the... they rather pale into insignificance. I want to talk about some aspects of the financial crisis and some of the broader context of this crisis, and it actually fits quite well what I want to say with some of the contributions in the last session this morning, which I heard. The first point I want to make is that the crisis is often presented as a financial crisis, and of course that's what it was in 2008, a major financial crash, and many of the events which we most associate with it are events which have to do with the financial markets, so that the most iconic event of all is the Lehman's crash in 2008, when the authorities decided not to rescue that bank, and as a result the whole financial system wobbled and then required the major rescue which was launched. So you had the unlikely scenario of Hank Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, ended up intervening to save the banks. And the banks have remained at the centre of the crisis. But the crisis, as it's gone on, it's been revealed as not just a financial crisis, but a much deeper crisis about the whole nature of the political economy. So the crisis has morphed quite quickly after 2008 from a financial crisis to a fiscal crisis, and then a sovereign debt crisis. So it moved quite quickly to involving the whole question of the nature of the state and the relationship of the state to the economy. At first, there was talk about the return of the state, even the return of Keynes, a rather unlikely phenomenon. And the more the crisis went on, the more it became clear that there wasn't going to be any quick resolution. And the fact that even today, now 4 years after the crisis, many countries have still not regained the level of output that they had before the crash is a signal, signal evidence of the depth of this crisis. So, and there's been talk about whether we're whether the Western economies in particular are facing a Japanese-style deflation, a lost decade. So I think one of the fundamental issues is in thinking about the financial crash of 2008 and the crisis which has followed on from it, is what kind of crisis this is, whether it's comparable to the 1930s or the 1970s, or whether it's something new. There are clearly huge political uncertainties as the epicenter of this crisis has moved. And we need to be clear about the different ways in which we use in everyday speech the notion of crisis. We use it both to refer to moments of danger, which require which are critical situations which require immediate action to resolve, and then the other familiar use of crisis, which is about impasses, long drawn out impasses in political systems, which where the causes are structural and deep-seated, and which lead to a succession of deadlocks. And when we look at the crisis across the world, what we see are a number of major deadlocks which are preventing a resolution of this crisis. There are many, and there were some talked about this morning. There are three that could be picked out as particularly prominent. The one in the United States over their debt crisis, the approaching fiscal cliff. There's the crisis in the Eurozone over sovereign debt and the nature of the Eurozone and the huge difficulties of resolving that crisis. And there's also, I'd suggest, a major deadlock within China over the future of the Chinese model, which the new leadership has to grapple with. Now, I don't want to go, as I haven't got time, into the nature of those deadlocks, but I want to focus that one of the things that underlies them all and underlies deadlocks in other countries, and the reason why these crises are often so far-reaching and so drawn out, is that because underlying them is what can be called the crisis of the tax state. The what we have back again is a fiscal crisis which was much analysed in the 1970s but then passed somewhat out of fashion. It was analysed much earlier by Joseph Schumpeter, who called it the crisis of a tax state. And the reason why the idea of a tax state is so important in understanding the state-society relationships which are involved here is that capitalism for 200 more years has been based upon three different types of household: private households, corporate households, and the public household. And the new public household, which has developed in the 20th century, developed new functions, common needs for the new commercial society: defense against external attack, enforcement of law, protection of property rights, stable money, which were the traditional functions. And to those were added the three key enlargements in the 20th century: the adoption of normative economic policy from the 1930s onwards around stabilization and growth, the investment in science and technology, and normative social policy redressing social and economic inequalities. And the point about the tax state in all capitalist economies is that it expands under pressure from private and corporate households and from agencies in the public household itself. It was Rudolf Goldscheid who said that the budget is the skeleton of the state stripped of all misleading ideologies. And the political problem always for the tax state is how to prevent the continual encroachment of the tax state upon the private economy, upon the private sector. So that fiscal crises, which often follow financial crises and are associated with them, fiscal crises are actually a means by which the state is slimmed down again and is made proportionate to the private sector economy. So that fiscal crises play a very important role in the overall capitalist cycle in restoring the controls that are necessary for the capitalist economy to survive. After all, the whole way in which the tax state operates is to make the state, the funding of the state, dependent upon the health of the private sector economy. But the problem is that in order to make it successful, the state has to, this is the paradox of the tax state, there have to be political coalitions which will support the particular programs, the particular spending programs of the state. And so what George Philip called today fiscal populism is, I would argue, present in all states, that you have this cycle of fiscal populism and fiscal conservatism. And that even the fiscal conservatives, you find, have a fiscal populist side, because they have themselves, they can't, we heard again this morning about the constitutionalization of neoliberalism. What the modern state cannot do is pursue a neoliberal policy which is not grounded in political coalitions. So even the most diehard neoliberal has to find a political coalition to support the particular policies which they support. And that means political compromises. It means creating a coalition that will support some of the spending problem programs of the tax state. And it's in a fiscal crisis, what you get are the rival programs and the rival coalitions clashing in the most dramatic way over the size and shape of the state and the future spending programs which are which make the state legitimate and which allow the resumption of economic growth. And where you have a very severe economic crisis is where it is very difficult to achieve that resolution, and so you have a long drawn out standoff. And that seems to be what we're having in many different parts of the world at the moment, a long drawn off standout without any very clear sense of when this is going to end. But I will end there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next speaker, Professor Mary Caldor. Before coming to the LSE, Professor Caldor worked at Sussex University as Jean Monnet reader in contemporary European studies. She is highly regarded for her innovative work on democratization, conflict, and globalization. She was also a founding member of European Nuclear Disarmament, a founder and co-chair of the Helsinki Citizens' Assembly, and a member of the International Independent Commission to investigate the Kosovo crisis established by the Swedish Prime Minister. Mary.
Well, thank you also. I echo Andrew's thanks for inviting me. And I think it's a very timely conference. What I really want to talk about is the role of social movements and protests in crises like this one. And, of course, I'm going to focus on this one. And the main thing I want to say is that the wave of protests that we saw last year and continuing into this year in the Middle East and Europe should not be understood as a reaction to the financial crisis. I think the way to understand it is that I think the social movements, the new social movements, the new protests are maybe a product of the same causes as the financial crisis. So what I want to say is sort of three things about relating to this. The first is that I think we should see, like Andrew Campbell, I don't think we should see this just as a financial crisis. I think money's always an expression of power relations. And the way I would put it, and because I've only got 10 to 15 minutes, I'm not going to go into great length, is that I would say what this financial crisis is the expression of is the crisis of the, if you like, the 20th century mode of development, which was based on mass production and the intensive use of oil. And a key element of that mode of development, I think, was the central role of the nation state. And so, to put it very briefly and to make an assertion rather than giving you all the arguments why I think this is so, I think one thing one could argue is that this actually is the crisis of the nation state. You know, we're living in a world where economies, markets have broken through the boundaries of the nation state, and that's not the only reason it's the crisis of the nation state. It's also that the nation state has got frozen and stuck in a previous mode of development. And we've got to break out of this if we're to break out of the crisis. So that's the first point I want to make. The second point I want to make is that basically, if you really examine what people are saying in the squares and the protests, this new wave of social movements, as I said, is not a reaction to the financial crisis or a reaction to austerity as it's portrayed largely in the press. It's all about politics. We've just done a big study of what we call subterranean politics in Europe, in which we sent teams out, 7 field teams across Europe. And strikingly, the conclusion was the same in all of them, and I think you find the same if you talk to people in the Middle East, is what people were protesting about was the sense that they feel blocked at a national level. They don't feel represented. They don't feel democracy represents them. Their slogans were real democracy now, a Tahrir Square in every neighborhood. So it was all about a frustration with the political elite rather than a reaction to austerity. And I think a third point that one might make about this to, in a way, strengthen the argument I'm making, is that while there was a big focus on these movements and protests last year, actually, these have been building up over a 10-year period. And interestingly, I mean, we at my unit, we publish something called the Global Civil Society Yearbook, and we track this kind of activism. Actually, what happened last year, certainly in Europe, was no bigger, no more joined up than protests that have been happening over the last 10 years. Think, for example, of the protests just before the Iraq War, when there were some 11 million who demonstrated across the world. Think, for example, of the climate change action we've had over the last 10 years. But what happened during the financial crisis was that these protests became much more visible. Very interestingly, and also, they were not just happening in the countries where there was an austerity crisis. They were just as important, for example, in Germany, as they were in Britain or Spain. Two examples to make the point about the visibility. One is that the terms of last year the Wutbürger, the angry citizens in Germany, and indignados in Spain were not terms that the protesters themselves coined. They were terms coined by the press. So indignados came from this pamphlet. I don't know if any of you have seen it, written by Stefan Hassel, who was a leader of the French resistance. He's 94, called Indignez-vous, Be Indignant. And Wutbürger became the word of the year in the Deutsche Gesellschaft für die Deutsche Sprache. It's the Society for the German Language. And I think my favourite example is that of Occupy London. Actually, if you went to the square, and some of you might have done, many of the people were people who'd been sitting in front of Parliament Square since 2003 or had been involved in climate change action. But nobody took any notice of what was happening in Parliament Square. What changed was the visibility of Occupy. It caused a crisis in the Church of England about the most establishment institution we have, with two high officials resigning. They got to write an article in the Financial Times. I mean, imagine if the Parliament Square activists had been invited to write an article in the Financial Times, and bankers passed by and gave them funds. So my point really is that actually these were political protests going back for a period since, I would say, around 2000, but they simply became much, much more visible and affected the mainstream in a way they hadn't earlier. And just to support that, this is only for Europe, but the Eurobarometer figures are absolutely shocking if you look at them. What you find is that all over Europe, more than a large proportion of the population do not trust their government and do not trust political parties. They trust political parties even less than governments. The figure for the UK, 86% do not trust the mainstream political parties. So this crisis of democracy and crisis of the political elite, that's my first big point. This is what this is all about. And the second point I wanted to make was a general point about the role of social movements in affecting institutional change. Social movements, which is a very loose term, and I don't want to get into big definitional questions, but they're movements that rise and fall. They're movements, protests is part of what they do. They're movements offering an alternative discourse, and they rise and fall. And at their height, they either manage to change the discourse, which means they become institutionalized, their ideas are accepted on the dominant agenda, or they disappear, or they become marginal, or they turn to violence. And I think what you can see is key moments, both when social movements emerge and when they become institutionalized. And those key moments that I want to describe are one could go further back, but I'm not going to go further back. Just 1945, 1968, 1989, and 2011. And what I want to say about those key moments is they're both beginnings and endings. So I think 1945 was an ending, and it was the moment that the labour movement became institutionalized. Socialist parties came into power. People who were movement activists became institutionalized in trades unions. Trades unions became partners, and there was this whole shift to the dominant discourse of the welfare state. 1968, I would argue, was a beginning. And 1968 was the moment when there was the beginnings of a reaction to the dominance of the nation state. And actually, you had two reactions, a right reaction and what one might call either a left or an emancipatory reaction. The right reaction was the neoliberal reaction, and the emancipatory reaction is what in those days was called the new social movements, who came to be concerned with green, peace, human rights, feminist issues. And of course, the intervening period is the period when these movements, having gone through this exciting moment of demonstration, it changes their lives and they work on the things that they were really concerned about. So the real hard work of social movements is in the period between these moments. And I would argue that 1989 was another ending. 1989 was the moment when the new social movements, as it were, became institutionalized, particularly in Eastern Europe. But also it was the moment that they transformed from being movements to NGOs. And if you like, I would argue that NGOs, which for people of my generation are quite a recent phenomenon, were the institutionalization of the new social movements. And what's interesting about the NGOs is that even at that time, they felt themselves to be blocked at national levels. National levels were occupied by mainstream political parties, so very often they became international and global. And what you see, the period of the 90s, as a period when of great success for human rights, women's issues, the whole humanitarian discourse, but also a period of great success for neoliberal ideas. I think the new social movements took the achievements of the labour movement for granted and assumed they were adding on to that. And what you get at the beginning of the 2000s is an emergence of a whole new set of movements that are not only concerned with the issues of the old new social movements, but also concerned with social issues. And this was really embodied in what happened in Seattle at the World Trade Summit in 1999, and then the founding of the World Social Forum. And you had these huge social forum gatherings throughout the early 2000s, which actually were largely invisible. And the movements that sprung up in 2011 were very much influenced by that past, but were very different. And they were, I think you can see something similar happening in the Middle East. There's quite a history to, for example, the demonstrations in Tahrir Square. And I always say, actually, just as I say, it's not true that 1989 was not predictable. There were movements in Eastern Europe, and anyone who was involved in movements could see that. It's also true, I think, about 2011. I think the problem is that a lot of political science focuses on the behavior of states, on top-down politics, and doesn't notice these subterranean changes. But what I do think is that 2011 is a beginning rather than an ending. And I'm rather worried about that, and that's really my final point, because what I feel is missing is the middle generation. I think there's a huge gap between the mainstream and these new social movements. You see it in the Middle East. One of my Middle Eastern friends said the real problem with what's happening in the Middle East is the mediocrity of the middle, that somehow there isn't a generation that went through these experiences that is able to translate what's happening in the squares into political practice. And I think it'll take a long time before the momentum that's been built up over the last 2 years is actually translated, if it ever is, into institutional change. And the final point I want to make is that these kinds of moments, when there is this huge gap between politics and between mainstream politics and, if you like, subterranean politics, are moments which often lead to violence, which often lead to war. And previous turning points of this kind have always involved war. I mean, I think the whole period from 1914 to 1945 was such a turning point. Because somehow the institutions can't adapt to the to the crisis because there's no kind of engine to adapt the institutions. And what happens then is incredibly dangerous for the long term and for the future of what for the future paths of getting out of the crisis. I'm not suggesting that there's going to be two world wars like the 20th century, but actually I think there already is what I call a new war going on, even in Greece, where you see the rise of criminality, you see the rise of xenophobia, you see people living in quite violent situations. But what you're seeing in the Middle East is the conflict in Syria, the conflict in Gaza, with all kinds of different powers going on. And these are sort of deep-rooted forms of insecurity which involve a kind of mixture of criminality and extreme ideologies, sectarianism, jihadism, that are relatively low level compared with the major wars of the 20th century, but are nevertheless terribly, terribly difficult to solve or overcome. And so I'm rather pessimistic. And whether these new movements can create a new kind of agenda that can get us out of this violence over the next 20 years is a big question mark. Thank you.
Our third speaker, Sotirios Sartalodis. Dr. Sartalodis joined the Department of Politics of the University of Manchester in January 2012. Prior to his arrival, he pursued a PhD in European Studies at the LSE. He also holds an MSc in European Politics and Governance from the LSE. Sotirios has taught extensively on the European Union, history, politics, policies and governance, comparative political economy, and international politics at the LSE, College of Europe in Bruges, and the Southwestern University of Finance and Economics of China. Sotirios.
Thank you very much. Allow me also to thank you once again for the invitation and participation in this project. I will speak, I will give a very brief talk about the Greek case, and I'm happy to say that the points that were raised by Professor Gamble and Professor Calder are very relevant for the Greek case. And I will say why they're relevant while I speak. So the overview of my presentation is the following. First, I will speak about the Greek politics before the crisis, then the Greek response to the crisis, how Greece dealt with or did not deal with the crisis, and also the main discussion will focus on the impact of the crisis on perceptions in Greece, political behavior, and on the political system, on the Greek, if you like, the core of the institutionalized politics in the country. So before the crisis, it was a very happy period for Greece. Everybody was, or more, most of the population was quite happy. Greeks were very comfortable and very kind of, if you like, feeling successful that they were living in one of the most stable democratic periods in modern Greece since the revolution or the fight against the Ottoman Empire in 1821. It was Greece never had a proper and kind of well-functioning democracy. After 1974, with the fall of the colonel's regime, with the fall of the junta, it was a stable democratic system with mass legitimacy. The two big countries, the New Democracy and the PASOK, were getting around 80% of the vote. Most commentators were saying, and most scholars were saying that the Greek democracy and this kind of period was, if you like, a showcase that, you know, even countries with no or limited democratic experience can have a democracy. The leading figure of this period, even though the person who kind of brought the democracy to Greece was Karamanlis, the main actor in modern Greece was Andreas Papandreou, the father of the George Papandreou, the prime minister who had to deal with the crisis. And I would argue that if you want to find one culprit of the crisis, if you want to see to find one person to blame about the situation in Greece now, it's that person over there. By the way, there was a saying in ancient Greece that was saying that the actions of the parents haunt the children. And unfortunately, the son of this previous prime minister, George Papandreou, had to deal with the actions of and the results of his father's. So what happened in Greece, and what happened during this period, and why I say that this Andreas Papandreou can be considered as this kind of culprit, if you want, or this kind of main personality that we can influence the Greek crisis and the Greek politics. First, we had a kind of socialism regime, like PASOK means the Pan-Hellenic Socialist Movement of Greece. But we didn't have so much of a socialism, proper socialism. We had a socialism a la Greek. So what was the socialism? It was founded and it was based on populism and charismatic authority. So for those of you who have read Max Weber's work on charismatic personalities and leadership, that was one of the best examples. It was a PASOK party and PASOK-led government, but it was basically an Andreas Papandreou government, right? People were voting this party for Andreas Papandreou. We had also bureaucratic clientelism. So the government was using the state to manage the economy and the state in a kind of clientelistic fashion. We also had the so-called pro-people policies. The pro-people policies were some good and some not so good. The good policies were the establishment of a proper welfare state, the establishment of a national health system, the establishment of an adequate social security system, education system, free education system. By the way, when I came to the LSE for my master's, I was shocked that I had to pay for my books. In Greece, they were for free. Also, you could get free rent and free food if you were a student. So, you know, very kind of, if you like, generous welfare policies. The bad aspect of these pro-people policies were that we had a successive pay rises to all workers, which were not linked to competitiveness. We also had a lot of, if you like, expansion of the public sector without improving the efficiency of the public sector. And also we had another, if you like, negative, very negative policy, the policy of institutionalization of tax evasion. So the Greek state decided to subsidize informally a lot of the small companies in Greece by trying to turn a blind eye to the economy and the taxation. I was recently in an event organized by a think tank, the Policy Network, and it was Bill Clinton there, and he said that, you know, Greece is a case that justifies both the criticism of the left to the right and the criticism of the red of the right to the left. So we have tax evasion, not proper taxation, and also expansionary fiscal policy. The result of that, in 9 years, the debt from 20% went to 89%, and in 1 or 2 years more, it went above 100. We had successive deficit, and also we had a destruction of the country's competitiveness. However, we had a generation that lived relatively well, a generation that was more or less okay, the generation of my parents, the baby boomers, who unfortunately passed the bill to me and to my generation. So now the generation of young Greeks have to pay this debt that was accumulated in the 80s. And we're going to discuss the impact of this, if you like, social contract. So what happened when the crisis came to Greece? Initially, there was denial. George Papandreou was saying that Greece has no problem. It's only the euro that the financial predators and speculators are attacking. So don't worry, Greece doesn't have a problem. So until he was elected in 2009, until the signing of the Memorandum of Understanding, and I will say why it's so important, why I have, you know, this kind of critical juncture. By the way, one of the questions that we have to deal in this project was whether this crisis is a critical juncture. And I argue that it was a critical juncture in policy, economics, and politics. So, you know, it was, if you like, a paradigm change in Greece. Why? Because after the Memorandum of Understanding, where until then there were not important measures to deal with the problems of Greece. As I said, there was denial. We had extensive and consecutive cuts to all, so salaries, pensions, public investment. We have increasing taxation, especially indirect taxation. Why? Because we cannot tax people, so we cannot find how many money a lawyer earns or an economist earns or an engineer earns, because we have a lot of small companies in Greece that are family-owned businesses, so they never declare their real income, and it's very difficult to catch them. Also, we have a lot of corruption in the tax collection system. There was an academic in Greece who was hired by George Papandreou. By the way, George Papandreou was the exact opposite of his father. He really wanted to make Greece a proper European country. So he hired this highly educated academic to do a proper taxation system, and he found out that most of the people working in the tax collection agency had a principle called 4-4-2. For those that know football, you know that this is a 4-4-2 is a kind of, if you like, famous way to set up your team, right? But in the Greek case, it meant that I take four. If you have to pay 10 euros, the agent will pay 10, will get four. Sorry, the company will win four, and the two will go to the country's budget, to the taxation policy. In addition to that, we have unprecedented unemployment. We have 25% unemployment in general and 52% unemployment for the young people, which is unprecedented in Greece. We never even had this kind of unemployment even during the Nazi occupation or even between the interwar period. Also, we have one of the most severe recessions in Greek's modern history. Since the 18th century, Greece never had a recession. In addition to that, in addition to this kind of economic turmoil, we have also a political turmoil. Until the latest elections, there was political instability. The main party in opposition, the New Democracy, which kind of, if you like, created a lot of this mess that we live now, because from the 5 years before the crisis, they ran excessive deficits. They were not supporting Papandreou. We had a lot of, if you like, wrangling between the parties. We ended up in a technocratic government, two snap elections. As I say, while the boat was sinking, happily it was not synced, as we know now with the latest Eurogroup report, decision, that Greece will get the next financial help and also some debt relief. So what happened on perceptions? What was the impact on perceptions? First of all, we had a rise of populism. So Greece traditionally has a very populistic political system that went even to the extreme. We had the rise of nationalism and conspiracy theories. We had a kind of new cleavage, and this goes to this draws on the Andrew Gamble's point about the standoff, that the crisis can lead to two different opposing camps where you cannot actually decide. This is exactly the case in Greece. We have the so-called pro-memorandian people, the people who support the MOU, so people like PASOK, Papandreou, and now Venizelos. We have a New Democracy and the Democratic Left, the three parties that are now in government, and we have the also so-called anti-memorandians. And this, by the way, draws nicely to what Professor Caldor mentioned about the fate of the social movements. So this kind of cleavage was legitimized and kind of popularized by protest movements. So the protest in Greece was saying these are memorandians, these are, they are following what Merkel says. This both comes, the debate in Greece is very divisive. It's on the brink, if you like, of hearing a civil war discourse. So we have some people saying that these people are traitors. The pro-memorandians have signed to what Merkel is doing and they are not representing Greece. They should be hanged outside the parliament. On the other hand, we have the memorandians who say that these people are populists and they want to take us back to the drachma and they are against Europe. Violence is becoming an increasingly accepted means of political expression, especially among the opposition. And this goes again back to what Professor Caldor mentioned about this unofficial war, if we can call it like that. Yes, there is something like that in Greece going on. There are some neighborhoods that it's mostly for the center-right to go, some other neighborhoods that it's mostly for the center-left, some neighborhoods that you don't go because you may have protests while it's happening. So it's a bit sometimes like, I don't know if it's like that nowadays in Latin America, but definitely like some African countries where you have some neighborhoods where they are run by some guerrilla or some kind of informal networks. Political behavior. Similar to the perceptions, we have daily protest, strikes, demonstration. If you go nowadays in Athens, you'll see that most of the pavements, most of the buildings in the center of Athens are black, either from a lot of bombs or from gas bombs of the police or from stones. I went this summer in Athens and I was shocked because I live in Thessaloniki in the north of Greece, and I hadn't been in Athens since the crisis and I couldn't recognize the city. It feels that there's some kind of fog everywhere of black smoke. Trust in institutions and legitimacy in general in the political process has completely been almost to zero. Another point that was raised by Professor Caldor is that a lot of people are worried about the politics themselves. So we have also an indignant movement in Athens where they say that we don't live in a democracy anymore. We live in a dictatorship run by Brussels, run by Merkel and Sarkozy and now Hollande. There's a lot of legitimacy of people going and trying to hit or persecute a politician because these politicians are responsible for the crisis. The people chant when they go to a protest that we should burn down the parliament and the parliament should not be there. And we have a lot of, if you like the rise of extreme left and extreme right, as I said before, fights. We also have a big generational divide. Another point mentioned by Professor Calder, I didn't know that it would be so relevant for Greece. We have two generations in Greece nowadays. We have the people who are 35 and below, who don't like the political system, they don't like their country, they don't like what's happening in Greece now, and they vote for anything anti-systemic, be it Syriza or Golden Dawn. By the way, voting for Golden Dawn doesn't mean that you're Nazi, even though it's a Nazi party. It mostly means that I don't like that what's happening in my country and I want to vote somebody that will go in the parliament and create a mess. Also, we have the generation above 55, the baby boomers, the big winners of the Greek crisis, winners, if we can call it like that, who are still loyal to PASOK and to New Democracy. They say, no, these parties will save us. So it's a divided country, if you like, nowadays in Greece. So the impact of the political system, how all these developments resulted, what was the result in the Greek politics? First, we saw a dramatic reconfiguration of the political party system in Greece. The two main parties, similar to, let's say, Labour and Conservatives in the UK, are becoming increasingly small parties. PASOK from 44 went to 12. The first rate, that's even lower than when the party was created in before the 80s. From 80% combined vote, we have 40%. Anti-systemic protest movements and organizations are on the rise. We have some nationalist movements like one called Sparkle, which is led by Mikis Todorakis, who is a famous composer, who says that all these people are traitors, all these people should leave, all these people should take they have the so-called Argentine paradigm. They say they should take the helicopter and leave the country. We have the rise of the extremes, and here's a debate whether we can consider Syriza an extreme party. I consider Syriza an extreme party for the following reasons. In its title, it says it's the coalition of the far left, which is okay. We can debate about what it means. But also, part of the Syriza are groups where they are Trotskyists, communists, neo-communists, this kind of, if you like, the old Euro-communist model. And from 3%, it was a very small party. It was considered like this kind of party that, yeah, you know, it's there, but, you know, who pays attention to Syriza? It has become the main opposition party. And the current polls show that Syriza, in the next elections, whenever this will be held, it will be the first party. It will be the first time in the Greek history where a far-left party, if you don't like the term extreme, will be first. Also, Golden Dawn from 0.1 went to 7%. Current polls show that Golden Dawn will be the third party and PASOK will be below the 10% threshold, which is a threshold, informal threshold to consider whether you are a strong party or not. So, what can be the main conclusion of the Greek case? Greece is on the brink of collapse. It has entered a Weimar-like period where the main parties, the mainstream parties, are accused as traitors. They are accused as not Greek enough. They are accused as spies of the foreign powers, be it Germany, be it the IMF, be it the US. We have the dominance of violence, extremism and populism, and also parties that are anti-systemic but also anti-democratic. For instance, both Golden Dawn and Syriza have argued many times that, well, this kind of new regime that Greece has been living in the last 30 years, this kind of so-called democracy, as they call it, is not a proper system. We have to change it. By the way, both Syriza and Golden Dawn assume similar positions, which is a very frightening phenomenon in my view, because we have a left party that agrees with a very extreme right party. For instance, both Syriza and the leader Tsipras says that Papandreou was a traitor, that Papandreou was conducting a contract from some elites that are against Greece for some reason. Also, both of them say that if we get elected, everything will be fine. For instance, yesterday, Tsipras, the leader of Syriza, said that if I get elected as a first party, I will pass a law that all the salaries will be reverted back to before the crisis. So vote for me and all your salaries and your pensions will be back, right? That's an example of populism. Greece, on the other hand, the coalition that tries to keep Greece into the European Union and the Eurozone, has become one of the best students in Europe. Contrary to what you hear in the press about these lazy Greeks, these corrupt Greeks and all this discourse that we hear all the time, if you read the latest IMF report, it says that Greece has done an amazing job in implementing fiscal consolidation. It has implemented most of the measures required, and now it has to focus more on structural reforms that, as we all know, takes a lot of time. Greece, and at least if you like the coalition now in power, is ready to do everything to stay into the Eurozone and stay in Euro. Why? Because for them, being part of the European Union is vital to the survival of the Greek modern state as we know it, as a Western country. In addition to that, we know that, you know, even though Greece tries at least to comply, we know that it cannot pay its debt. They have already had one or two, it's a second now, debt relief process. It needs another one to go below 100%. The sooner the European Union does that, the better. They will do it, and I think that this kicking down the can, as Professor Rubini has called it, it's completely erroneous. It's completely counterproductive. So, to conclude, I will say that Greece is not a lost case, even though it seems like it in terms of politics. I think if Greeks get some hope, and when I say hope, it doesn't mean a concrete, if you like, improvement of living standards, but some kind of hope that, okay, we may give you some debt relief, or we may give you some measures for growth, we may give you some measures for liquidity for your companies, the coalition can survive. Otherwise, whenever these elections will happen, we're going to have some anti-European, anti-Western, anti-democratic, and anti-capitalist or free market parties in power, which will mean that unless they change their position immediately, Greece will be very difficult to. It will be very difficult for Greece to stay inside the European Union. So, on that happy note, thank you very much for your attention.
So we can open the floor. Nobody wants to be first. I will try to ask a question both to Andrew and to Mary, because you, in your own way, gave quite bleak and quite similar outlook of the current crisis, which is one of stasis rather than resolution. Andrew talked of a long, drawn-on standoff, and you picture this situation of significant sector of the population deeply alienated, that have, you know, joined the social movement, but they don't have the ability to translate that into changing the agenda and institutionalize it. So where does the change come from? How can this stasis be overcome, if you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think what
happens in these situations is that you can have a situation which is deadlocked for a very long period, but then suddenly you do get a shift. You have some unexpected event which causes a sudden breakdown. Of course, for the reasons Mary was saying, that's often associated with violence, and that's the problem. The problem is whether you can find negotiated solutions to these crises, but as we can see with the Eurozone, that is proving extraordinarily difficult, so that and the longer these crises go on, the greater the chance that there may be an actual break in the deadlock, which is caused by the eruption of violence, and then you have you can suddenly then have a period of very rapid political movement and rapid political change. But those sorts of situations are very uncomfortable to live through.
Well, you know, I'm not a political determinist, so I think it's always possible to change what happens. And let me say one or two bright things on the horizon. I mean, if you had said 2 years ago that the European Union would have accepted Eurobonds, they would have accepted a transaction tax, supervision of banking, all the things that many of us were arguing they needed to do, we would have been shocked and we would have thought this was impossible. The problem is they've sort of been introduced very reluctantly and by the back door. I mean, the transaction tax in particular, because this has been a major demand of the social movements to have a Tobin tax, could be used as a kind of political instrument, but it's not being used as a political instrument. So what I think would dramatically change things around would be if there were real profound changes at European Union level. I don't see those changes at national level. I think they have to be at European Union level. There has to be a rethink of what the European Union is. There isn't a political constituency for that, but at the same time, if they were seen to be not another neoliberal bureaucracy, but actually to stand for things that they'd always said they stood for, peace and social justice, you could imagine a turnaround, but it would they would have to act in a political way. And I think my problem is this generation, I mean, the only person who's sort of thinking at all along these lines, oddly enough, is Angela Merkel, I think. She's sort of come round to all these things, realising it's the only way to save the European Union, which she's very committed to. But what you see is every politician thinking in short-term political advantage and not thinking about the future public interest. I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, I was extremely irritated by the way the Labour Party, for short-term political gain, decided to vote with the Tories on the EU budget. That is just so irresponsible. It feeds Euroscepticism in this country. And while I think actually what happens here is probably marginal to what happens in the rest of Europe, I'd still like to see us as part of the European Union, and we seem to be on course for leaving it. But that's just a sort of typical example. And so I think what really worries me is that somehow there is, I mean, and now I'm being pessimistic again, it does require actually some far-sighted politicians that actually respond in a political way to some of the things that people are saying in the square. It doesn't mean they have to carry on. But there are, most people in parties like New Dawn are what, there's a rather good report just out by Counterpoint on the new right in Europe, reluctant radicals. They just don't see a home for themselves. And if there was just some kind of response, but that's not the way the political class think at the moment. And, you know, I think what was so shocking about Greece was that we all ended up very happy that there was a coalition of the two parties that had been the most corrupt. You know, we thought that was better than the alternative, which was Syriza and New Dawn. And that's a reflection of the total lack of any kind of inspirational political class. And oddly enough, I think George Papandreou was the only person in that situation, and he became the scapegoat for everything. So I suppose I do think there's a role for political action, is what I'm saying, but I don't see where it's going to come from.
Stephanie?
Yeah, I think what Mary said now is really correct, and I think there is an issue.
There is an issue where progressives, of course, could unite, which is on growth, because because the answer of austerity has failed. And, and you know, the people who've articulated the, so clearly, like Krugman and Stiglitz, but they just don't get listened to. And Hollande seemed to, in his campaign, he seemed to raise these issues, particularly at the European level. You know, he talked about reactivating growth, about using the European Investment Bank and all that. But since he's come to power, it seems to be a little bit timid. And as I mentioned in the morning, they, for example, have said that they will use the EIB, but in fact this year the EIB is lending less than last year, which is super pro-cyclical, completely reversed. They have not lent anything to Greece that they had promised. And I was recently at a conference there, and people were complaining about this, rightly. But there are people who are very conservative at the EIB, whom Merkel actually has put there, and who are say that they don't want to damage the credit rating of the EIB. So there is no vision. I mean, because, you know, it's like Roosevelt or people after the Second World War who had this vision. And because growth could be the answer, because if you tell these kids on the streets, the Indignados in Spain or the Syriza followers, well, right, because they're all unemployed, you know, you will have jobs. And there are economic answers. You know, the best thinkers have told what the answers are. And there's just no political vision to deliver that. And in a way, you're right. It could be Merkel. Merkel's always like, she sort of gets there, but it's so little so late. Not, as was said in the morning, because the markets don't like him. It's because the people don't like him. It was quite interesting, this gentleman who made a very good presentation, the keynote speaker this morning, but his reference point were the markets. But it must, and I think there is a problem there. Are you going to do things to satisfy the markets and the kind of neoliberal agenda which is so failed, or are you going to do the policies that will actually deliver an economy for people, to put it very simply?
The only thing I'd say about that is, I mean, of course I agree with you about needing growth policies, but I actually think what the young people on the streets are about is not actually about austerity per se, but about politics and their fed upness with the political elite and the sense that that they don't participate. And I think that requires not just... I don't think you could get the economic answer without a political answer. And I think it does require a political answer. The reason why I think the Tobin tax is so significant is not because of whether, you know, it's good economically or not, but because it was being one of the major demands of the movement. And I think there needs to be a different kind of political discourse about what the European Union is about. And there needs to be a real sense that the European Union is about giving back people the right to participation in a global age. That would be my argument. I think it would be great if they had an elected president, but I don't think it would solve the problem without a bigger political change, because I think if you had elections today for a president, it would probably be like the European Parliament, and sort of 20% would participate. So it would have to be the culmination of a more kind of political movement, and that means rethinking what the European Union is about. I mean, for my generation, we were passionate Europeanists because we thought it meant that Europeans would never go to war again, and we thought it was the vehicle for overcoming the Cold War division. That's history for the younger generation, and one of the striking findings of our study of subterranean politics in Europe was that on the one hand, issues about Europe were utterly irrelevant to most of the protesters. They weren't interested in Europe. But on the other hand, they very much felt themselves to be European. They took Europe for granted. They all travel around and go to different universities. So that was very interesting. And I think what we need is a new narrative for the European Union that would be about reinvigorating democracy at local levels and protecting local levels from global storms. At the moment, the European Union does the opposite. It's magnifying global storms through its austerity policy. But if the story was, you know, we're going to be a new kind of institution that taxes global ills like financial speculation or carbon emissions, and that promotes global goods and protects autonomy at local levels so you can really participate at local levels. We need a new story that's convincing of that kind.
Lawrence? Well, you first, and then Lawrence.
Yeah, I have a question. I think Professor Caldo, when you mentioned about, I think you call it mass production, I was thinking with regards to globalization. And I mean, I'm interested to see your views on this because I'm from Spain. And one of the things that I believe that Germany, especially by a lot of the press, is being blamed by not taking the leadership on this. But I will also think that one of the reasons why Germany is not so inclined to act is because now, for instance, the biggest export market for Germany is China.
I agree.
Okay, so I believe now France has fallen off their interest. And I mean, with something that I think Professor, you mentioned your Sartorioides, and I think it's very interesting, is our generation don't see the don't have the same buying as our parents that were that saw a war. Right, so I don't think maybe it's a lack of the way the politicians are explaining what are the benefits for our generation to be part of the euro. And I think that is really going back to the basics. Someone has to explain to the Southern Europeans and to the Northern Europeans why do we want to be together. And I think that is probably what is missing. I'm interested to know what you think.
I completely agree with you, actually. I don't have anything really to add to what I said, but I totally agree with you. That's really what I was trying to say. We need a new story of the role that the European... And in a curious way, I think the European Union already does do that. I mean, if you look at the role that the European Union plays in the global context, it is actually playing a very active role on climate change. It is pursuing human rights issues, and it isn't being a kind of classic superpower like the United States. It's the sort of institution that many people would like, but it's not very effective, it's divided, and it has all its... So that kind of narrative, that story of what the European Union is politically, needs to be reinvented.
Lawrence and...
It was good to have the vivid description of what's going on in Greece from Sotirios, but maybe in order to link it with the rest of the project, it would be at the rest of the conference, there are a couple of questions about what's the meaning of Greece for everybody else. You know, I think a first reaction was to think maybe this was just irrelevant. It's a sad story, but it's not for all of us. But then you see what's happening in Portugal, you see to some extent what's happening in Spain. There's a definite sense that maybe the story you're telling us has a broader resonance. And there were particular things you said which it seems to me might be taken up perhaps by other speakers. You said, for example, and these are not, I think, specific to Greece, the discredit of the dominant parties, the destruction of the country's competitiveness, and the baby boomers improved their living standards but sank their children in debt. That starts being rather a recurrent theme across rather a lot of countries. So I wonder if you'd like to say a bit more about whether what you're observing in Greece is, as it were, a foretaste of the future for us all, or is it a scare story? What's its status in this collective comparative study?
You want to take the challenge, Andrew?
I think Greece probably Greece is a very extreme case at the present time, but I think there is a danger that Greece becomes the pattern of other European states. And I think that's the danger of these kinds of crises, that if you once the basic functioning of your tax state begins to collapse, then your democracy also collapses or polarizes. And that's these things then become very very linked, so that most countries, one would expect, will escape the extremes to which like I said, it's not that Greece is going to be multiplied right across the whole of Europe or in other parts of the world, but the longer this situation goes on and is not resolved at European level or by some other dramatic events like Greece electing a government that decides to pull out of the euro and pull out of the EU, unless at all those sorts of events happen, we have this sort of slow torture that is going on for many of the peoples of Europe, and for all the reasons that the other two speakers have mentioned, you then have the problem that the political class is losing all the time, losing trust, and losing the ability to actually command the situation. And that's what's dangerous about these standoffs, these long deadlocks. People lose faith in politics and in a political process. They then turn to other. They lose faith in the established political process. They then turn to other political solutions. So I think Greece is a huge warning. I mean, the only thing I'd say is what is remarkable in many of these countries is the capacity for suffering. I mean, how long drawn out these things can be without an explosion, without an absolute eruption. And that's one of the things I always find extraordinary, that populations can, that people find ways of coping somehow in most dire situations.
Well, I think on that point, they just have to. I mean, I think eruptions happen when they're kind of organised and usually when people are better off. Mm-hmm. I think, on the contrary, this is what collapse looks like. People say there's going to be a moment of collapse, but it's there already, and it is long, slow, drawn-out torture. What I also think is that I don't think it can be isolated to Greece. I think it's very likely if you just look at the whole thing logically, we simply can't go on sustaining this endless cycle of austerity, and Greece will probably leave, and then if Greece leaves, the next countries will be Portugal, Spain, Ireland. So, you know, and you might be left with a little EU rump, which in my view would be very sad. So I think it is a really dangerous situation. I just wanted to say one thing about the movements, which is interesting, which is that although they, as I said, they hardly talk about Europe, and they, when they do talk about Europe, they see it as another neoliberal institution like the IMF. But what is true is there's a huge amount of solidarity. So one of the slogans you'll find everywhere is, "We're all Greeks now." The other thing is that although the protests are very local and specific, they are quite internationalist. One of the things I really liked about the Spanish protests is that you don't see any Spanish flags. What you see are Icelandic flags, because Iceland is supposed to be the model of how you deal with the financial crisis. Egyptian flags, because Tahrir Square's supposed to be the model of democracy, and Palestinian flags to symbolize justice. So I think that's quite an interesting aspect which one might hope people could build on.
So please.
I think that I would agree with the previous comments on that the Greece is an extreme case, but it's an extreme case of what? I think it's an extreme case of things that you shouldn't do. So, for instance, what lessons can be drawn from Greece? You should never have a budget and trade deficits for more, let's say, than 5-10 years. Greece had deficits in both in trade and in the balance account.
What about the US?
Yeah. Well, I think that we will soon.
Unless
soon,
you have the dominant currency.
I believe that also the US is following a very dangerous path in that respect. Also, you should never promise things to people that you cannot deliver. So the current parties who are running the country, and as Professor Caldo said, that we said, oof, you know, they were elected, even though they are the main kind of people that brought Greece to its knees, promise that, you know, for the next year, if you vote for me, for the next 4 years, you get more pensions, more salaries, more benefits, whatever. I think that politicians should be open and frank to the electorate and say, look, we're not doing well, we have to do 1, 2, 3, 4 things for this reason. And the other thing that the Greece can teach the rest is that no matter how you think you deserve things, Greeks think that they deserve things. They say that we are better than Europeans. We had Socrates and Plato when they were not even having anything there, right? We gave the name Europe to them. We always have to. I think that what the Greek case shows that this sense of entitlement that we have in Europe, you know, we should expect this as European citizens, is not granted. Is not a right. It has to be won somehow. How should we go on? By having a competitive economy, by having an efficient public sector, by having a properly taxed system. And this, for instance, the UK can learn a lot. The UK is notorious for not taxing the financial sector enough. And I think we see a lot of problems for that. So I think that the Greek case may be extreme, but it's kind of, you know, the worst case scenario if we don't be careful enough. So I think it's a warning sign for everybody in the European Union, and I think in the West in general.
Yes.
I think between you, you've given a thoroughly depressing account with absolutely every reason for giving it. At one level, I almost feel sorry for politicians in that they're being voted out often, and it wasn't actually their fault, but they were in and there was an economic crisis, so they get thrown out, and the electorate just vote in the other lot, whether they're extremists or the left in France. I mean, many of the strange votes have gone to right-wing parties to punish governments for following neoliberal policies. Now, how logical is that? It's absolutely crazy. But in defence of politicians, what on earth can they do? I mean, Obama is a wonderful example. People voted for him to change the society, to some extent. I mean, obviously the right didn't. But he couldn't, because of the political situation, because of the power of Wall Street, because of the power of multinational corporations. He was stuck, and I think he's probably going to be stuck for the next 4 years. Cameron, if he wanted to change British society, well, he was in with a coalition. He couldn't change it. People are indifferent, but they're indifferent because they don't see their politicians doing anything to really change the situation. So the police voting in Britain, 15% turnout. Sometimes politics turns violent, as in the Middle East, after a build-up of 30 years, 40 years of military rule. But most of the time, I think it just is indifference, which is why the Eurobarometer polls or the Latino barometer polls all show there's no confidence in most of the institutions. Isn't the real problem that we're talking about national leadership in an environment where everything's gone global? And the Tobin tax, which I would fully support, hasn't got a chance of being introduced because
it's been agreed by the European Union.
Well, in a bit of Europe, but not with British bankers, not with New York bankers, not with Japanese bankers. So it won't work properly. I don't think it will work, and I think it will be undermined, even though I would fully support the thing. But the real problem is that power is above even the EU. You've said some good things about the EU, but it's also, not only do they say do they do good things? But they also have their common agricultural policy. They're inefficient. They allowed Greece and Spain to get away with murder. So while there are good things, I mean, I'm a committed European, but I can't see all that. I'm not all that favourable to the Economic Commission and so on. So my problem is, if you've got indifference to politics, and politicians at the national level are stuck because there are so many constraints on their action, economic, political, and financial, how on earth do you get out of this situation? And I'm not sure there is a way out. But politics is individualistic, and Greece will go one way, Egypt another, Latin America will go another, and so on. But can we rely on politicians? Do they have a chance? Angela Merkel has to win an election in Lower Saxony and nationally. She seems to be getting away with it, but the constraints on her are serious.
I think politicians. I think you're right. I mean, being in politics is extremely extremely difficult. But I think the some politicians, nevertheless, as Mary was saying earlier, some politicians who have vision actually do find ways within all the constraints that hem them in, actually to change things. And obviously, it depends on circumstances. But there is also a factor of will and of building coalitions and building the support for the policies that you need. Angela Merkel is an interesting case. There was a very interesting opinion poll, I think, earlier this year or last year, which showed that majority of Germans voters were now against Germany's membership of the euro. But the same poll also showed that a majority of German voters trusted Angela Merkel to do the right thing. And I thought, actually, there's very few political leaders anywhere in the world that have that level of trust. Now, she may not have it next year by the time the elections come, but I think it is interesting. It shows that it is possible for political leadership actually still to generate trust, and those leaders that can generate trust and can build a coalition behind them, they are the leaders who have the opportunity to take risks and to do things which other leaders cannot. And it's what David Woodruff was saying this morning. I mean, like Putin or not, I mean, actually what he was showing was that Putin managed to create a coalition on the back of the devaluation of the ruble, which left behind the failed policies of the 1990s and left behind the image of Russia as a declining power and a state that was weak. Putin offered a different vision. Now, I'm not recommending the adoption of Putin policy, but it shows what politics can do in certain circumstances. And I very much the problem with Europe at the moment, it seems to me, the European Union, is that it's either doing too much or it's doing too little, and that it. If you look at it in terms of its tax state fundamentals, the European budget is 1% of the European GDP. The American federal budget is around 18-20%, and that actually tells you all you need to know in structural terms about the capacity of the US. Federal government and the capacity of the very embryonic European federal government. And it's the fact that all the politics is concentrated in the national tax states and not in the European tax state. So there is very little conception of a European public household, and that makes it very difficult, and as Mary was saying, hardly any European politicians are any longer prepared to argue a vision for Europe, for the European public household, as a way of resolving this crisis. Instead, we have it always at the level of what is it going to cost my taxpayers within all the separate national jurisdictions. And I think that's until that is broken, until there are until we have a political leadership in Europe that's prepared to create a coalition across Europe, then I don't think that's going to change.
You want to say something?
Yeah, I do. If you don't mind, I've got 4 points. One is, don't let's get too enthusiastic about Angela Merkel. What I think is, I mean, I've heard her speak and she seems really nice. But, and she said at this speech that I was listening to, I'm ready to take whatever it takes to save the euro. The problem is that she genuinely believes that the only way to save the euro is through imposing fiscal austerity. And that's a huge barrier. She genuinely believes this silly stuff that everybody's saying, that government budgets are like household budgets and, you know, you mustn't get into debt. Actually, I think if you want to break out of a situation, you should go and borrow to go to university or whatever. But anyway, that I think it applies to households as well. But anyway, she genuinely has this German belief. And I think that's a huge barrier to change. And of course, she's in a context where there are a lot of financial interests in Germany who want to keep interest rates low, who are perpetuating this belief. And why the memory of the 1924 inflation is more important than the memory of unemployment, which they keep invoking, is not because it is more important, but because they keep repeating it. So that's one point. The second point is that I think, and I've discussed this with Germans, they don't distinguish between reforms and austerity. And of course it's right that Greece has to reform, but that's not the same thing as austerity. And in fact, the two things maybe contradict each other, because it's very difficult to do reforms while you have austerity. I'm aware of the fact that the main business of reforms means putting a few corrupt people into prison and stopping tax evasion. But I think if the emphasis were all on that rather than austerity, Germans would understand. And I think that distinction, and actually I've talked with George Papandreou, and I think that was something they didn't realise when they came into power. And if they'd made that argument right at the beginning, it might have had a different outcome. I think they went too far along with the Germans, believing, I mean, particularly his Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was a very conventional, I mean, his Finance Minister, Papa Constantinou, who was a very conventional economist. Also, I mean, it's the conventional economics discourse that has had such a profound effect on everybody. And you see it here, too. I mean, everybody really believes this in austerity. So that's the second point. The third point I want to make is about national politicians. I think, in some ways, I mean, I agree very much with what you say, and that was the thrust of what I was trying to say, that this is a crisis of the nation state, that it has to do with globalization. But to some extent, globalization is a consequence as much as a cause of the crisis of the nation state. I think somehow everything got focused at nation state level, and it's got blocked and bureaucratized. And one of the things that always strikes me is that national politicians are so nervous about saying what they really think in case of the focus groups have a different opinion. And you contrast that with, for instance, Boris Johnson or Ken Livingstone, both mayors of London, who do say what they think and everybody loves it. And we much prefer politicians. We don't always like what they say, but we like the fact that they're sort of frank and open, in contrast to national politicians, which seem to me always terribly wooden and unreal. And I think that's partly is the sort of blocked context in which they find themselves. And the final point I wanted to make is that there is no politics at the EU level, and that's the problem. I mean, it's no accident that they picked Rompuy, Barroso and Cathy Ashton as their three leading figures, because they didn't want sort of big political characters who could lead Europe out. And that's one reason I am in favour of elections, even if I think that elections aren't the answer, that we might just produce a more exciting and more inspired political leadership for Europe, because I do think that's the key problem.
Adding to the previous comments is I think that politicians would be much better if they didn't care so much about re-election, but they cared about the right policies.
Yeah, exactly.
And for instance, the Greek case shows that a lot, and also we can see other European countries showing that, maybe the Irish case as well, where you have a problem, you know what to do, but you don't do it, and you pass the bill to the next one. Jean-Claude Juncker, when he was Prime Minister before he became part of the leader of the Eurogroup, said that we know what to do, but we don't do it because we know that we won't get re-elected. And the Greek case is the extreme example of not doing what you have to do. And I think that's a big problem. And I think a big part of this protest and this disillusionment with politics is that not only people don't see this kind of honesty and directness, but also they see that politicians, or the political system, is more about the kind of small political gains that you can get in everyday discourse and not about the long-term policies. If you see, for instance, if you study German politics, this year in Manchester I'm teaching German politics, so it's quite an interesting period to teach German politics being Greek, is that you see that one of the big advantages of the German democracy after the Second World War and why it got all this legitimacy was because they had some strong chancellors that they said, this is what we have to do, and we have to do it. And I think we miss that both at the EU level and at the national level. Very few leaders are being honest and say, look, we have a difficult situation, and I'm doing it not for me, I'm doing it for the best of the country. And to the defense of Papandreou, Papandreou was one of them. Papandreou said, I don't care, I will do what I have to do for Greece to stay in the Euro. And I think we need more people like Papandreou, even though now everybody, is completely, let's put it mildly, they are very rude to him in Greece and also elsewhere, that as he was the puppet of Merkel, etc. But Papandreou, I think, took a major decision. He had a critical juncture to say, what do I do? Do I do whatever it takes to be in the Euro? Because this will be the best for my country, even if I will be destroyed politically, and he was destroyed politically. I think we missed that at the national level. Doing what you have to do, not what you will get re-elected.
But isn't there then an outcome of your war
allowing
on your currency as a result of that honesty?
The problem with people like Papandreou and Zapatero is that being progressive,
that's why you need also honesty.
I'm sorry about maybe we can follow this discussion in the coffee break, but we are already past the hour. We have the break now and reconvene at 4:30 and surely 3:30 and the conversation will continue.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you.
But I had no idea.